Welcome to the talky bit. I don't know if you've noticed, there's a billboard campaign around the city that's kind of a riff on a long-standing joke about how God communicates with humans, by which I'm not saying this is how God communicates with humans, but that's what the joke is predicated on. I can't remember offhand, and the thought came to me later in the week, and I wasn't out and about to be able to confirm this, but I think the organization behind the campaign is Turning Leaf. In any case, the billboard says something like, "If you were looking for a sign, this is it." And that reality that we might think of as sort of running in the background of that ad campaign is that as a species, we tend to be pretty good at looking for a sign. And some folks, in fact, have made the case that it's this variability that sets us apart, that makes us unique. In the animal kingdom, a very prolific author, religion scholar, Karen Armstrong, says that the distinguishing feature that makes us human isn't that we're tool makers, and for a long time that was the sort of celebrated thing that set us apart. We were the tool makers in the animal kingdom, but we've learned since that some animals do in fact make and intelligently use tools. And it's not that we have language. For a long time, anthropology and sociology, kind of the thing was that we're unique because we have and use language. But increasingly, we're discovering with more and more complexity that some animals do that, although animal language tends to be different than our language in the sense that ours is an assemblage of considered pieces designed to speak to meaning. Maybe we'll discover that animals do that too in due course. But in any case, language is not what sets us apart. But Armstrong suggests, and I would resonate with this, rather than either of those things, it's our capacity to imagine a higher power, not simply existing, but at work in the world. That's actually what sets us apart. That's what makes us human, as opposed to some other definition of alive. To put it another way, we seem to have, as a species, both the capacity and the inclination to, look for a sign, right? And as we continue to demonstrate with more and more clarity through research as we go, we tend to see in our looking for things, we tend to see what we're looking for. That's the way our filters work for all sorts of reasons. We could call it, say that that's because of how our brains are structured. We could call it confirmation bias. We could call it shortcutting. Well, we can call it human nature. But whatever we call it, if we're, looking for a sign of whatever type, we are more likely to see a sign than if we weren't looking for it. When we're not looking for a sign and we encounter something that feels like a sign, those tend to be quite memorable experiences. They're the exception, not the rule. And I mention all of that as sort of backgrounding for an idea that I want to spend a couple of talky bits exploring, which is the thought that this drive to see a higher power or some expression of mystery at work in the world, so not just to acknowledge its existence, but to see an intersection between its existence and our experience, that is truly one of the more enduring characteristics of humanity. And it's worth considering when it comes to exploring not just what we believe, which is what we're on about as a community all the time, but also why we're inclined to belief or systems of belief or to exploring belief or choosing to believe something about things that are hard to articulate, right? Hard to pin down. I had two experiences this past week that felt like they overlapped in a way that got my attention. Now, it might be that these experiences called out to me because I was thinking about today's talky bit as I went through my life this week, which is not an unusual experience. I do tend to have these things in mind in an ongoing kind of way. And because of that, I'm sort of, in the context of the language you're using today, I'm always sort of looking for my own signs, or my own illustrations of the things that I'm thinking about, and so I do tend to see them. So I had these two experiences. One experience was that I was helping Taya study for an exam that she needs to take at that point that she needed to take, has since taken, on the history of Christianity, which was a required course in her program of study. Now, the material itself was mostly material that I studied a long time ago. It was intriguing to review it. It was quite interesting. I found that the history of the religion in which I grew up was something that, although I was taught about it, I definitely studied it with less progressive historians than the one that Taya is learning from. And I'm glad for her in that regard, because although her prof has been clear about not having any particular agenda to push, they're not trying to say, here's what you need to believe as a result of the things that I'm going to share with you. He has been unreluctant about offering up information that would equip those that are willing to consider some rather big questions about the history of the Christian religion and what those questions might mean about where that religion comes from. Not least of all questions about whether it's has some kind of divine origins or whether it's a fully human construct. He's been unreluctant about sharing difficult or complex, challenging ideas with this group of undergrads. So I'm grateful for that, and grateful to have been able to review those things with Taya. She felt like the exam went well, for the record. Time will tell. The other experience was hearing an interview this past week with the very thoughtful American scholar of religion, Reza Aslan, whose book Zealot, Tim Penner referenced in last week's conversation about Jesus Christ Superstar, which, by the way, thank you to everyone who participated in that. It was quite intriguing and delightful, and a very, I thought, catalytic way to kind of pass through that that season that we sometimes call Easter. In this particular interview with Reza, he suggests that Islam, which is a religion in which he grew up, he has a very interesting personal story, having grown up in that religion, went to an evangelical youth camp as a teenager, had a conversion to evangelical Christianity, was very zealous in that particular expression of belief, went on to theological studies. This guy now has several graduate degrees and doctorate, et cetera, et cetera. But in the course of his education, realized that many of the things that he had been taught as facts were in fact not facts. And so moved away from that expression of faith, but kind of into a more complex expression of faith and belief, writes from and thinks from this vantage point that remains respectful of a wide range of beliefs. It really does a lovely job of operating at a complicated intersection. Anyway, Aslan suggests that Islam is just now entering the throes of its own reformation, which is something that Christianity, in terms of its own history, underwent in the 1500s. Another American contemporary, Phyllis Tickle, has suggested that in the history of Christianity in particular, about every 500 years is a big, what she calls, rummage sale, in which beliefs get sorted, and some are discarded, they're no longer relevant or needed, and others are regarded as continuing to have utility and be useful and attractive, and they're kept, and the system is adjusted accordingly. And she would say that she's an American writer and cultural observer. And so in American Christianity, at least, she would say that we're in the midst of just such a rummage sale right now, the previous one having taken place about 500 years ago in Europe in what is now generally referred to as the Reformation. So interesting overlap there, because among the other things, of course, that Theo was studying in the course of the history of Christianity was the Reformation. Now, so that was sort of the intersection for me. In some assessments, this contemporary setting for these current reformations, if we take that as an idea with merit, the current setting is grim. Fascism is on the rise around the world. Two-thirds of Americans believe that democracy is under threat. In Canada, I think the numbers would be a little less extreme, but they're certainly that concern is certainly present. I mean, all you have to do is look at the variety of responses to governmental directives in the lockdown to see that there are some people who believe a wide variety of things about how democracy is functioning in this culture at this time and whether it's doing its job as it ought or not. And the literal physical world is on fire in many instances, again, literally. There's just, as climate change happens, there's these huge impacts from it, and still getting hotter in ways that we're able to measure. And yet, despite all of that, we seem to still be spending a lot of our time and energy as people on matters of considerably less consequence than those sorts of things. I mean, we spend a lot of our lives looking at our phones and observing, you know, who's dissing who on social media or whatever it is, on matters that are arguably, I'm not saying they're not interesting, but compared to some of those themes, relatively trivial. Also, having said that, in the midst of all of that, we are also making adjustments, sometimes rummage sale style, to religions of all sorts, which is part of Aslan's point, right? That these reformations, these upheavals, are going on. And if you wonder about the merit of his observation about that in terms of Islam, I would point you to, among other things, the variety of responses from people of Muslim faith following 9/11. And there were a lot of people who responded to that the way as Muslims, the way that I find myself responding as someone with Christian history to the history of residential schools, which is that I want to get a t-shirt that says I'm not that kind of Christian, or something like that. You know, I don't fall to that inclination because I think the story is more complicated than that, and I want to stay in the complexity of it and stay honestly engaged in that. But I know that there were lots of Muslims in the United States who were not interested in being painted with the brush of terrorists simply because they named a certain religious identity. They would have wanted a t-shirt perhaps that said, I'm not that kind of Muslim, if you will, in this analogy, right? And they said as much publicly. My beliefs would never produce that outcome. Interesting. Complicated. Religion, as a category, is powerful. What we do as a species in the name of religion is often powerful, and the exercise of that power, the power of the collective belief, that beliefs that we might name with religious names, the exercise of that power often covers quite a range of activities. And if we think of those activities for a moment as existing on sort of a fantasy continuum, and I say fantasy because I'm going to use pure as an ideal here, you know, sort of only this and not that. That's a fantasy, I would say. But if we think about these religious activities as existing on a sort of fantasy continuum where there is this fantasy thing that we could call pure good on one end and pure evil on the other, then it would be fair to argue under that kind of a model that the things done in the name of religion cover pretty much the gamut of that continuum. As one of my former higher ed colleagues likes to point out, religion is just a category of human activity. It's a certain aspect of the cultural things that we make. Religion in itself is neither the problem nor the solution. What we do with or within that category is the matter that we need to pay attention to. Religion doesn't behave in a certain way all on its own. The behavior of religion is the behavior of its adherents, the choices of those who are a part of it. And there's real value in sort of standing back and observing the collective, I think, and sort of going, what are the themes here and all of that? Absolutely, there's value in that. However, sometimes in the process of standing back and observing the themes, we let ourselves off the hook as individuals and just generally as a species. And we're like, we treat religion like it was an animate thing on its own. And it's not. It is a way of naming what we're doing. And that's important. Another possibly helpful way in this conversation to think about religion is as a language. We could think about religion as a language that is made up of symbols and metaphors. And I mean, language is a collection of symbols, right? So I'm not just talking about religious symbols in some explicit way, but generally symbols and metaphors. And those particular images, those symbols and metaphors, in the context of religion, are assembled for a very specific task or purpose. And in this view, that purpose is to help us as humans to communicate something that is fundamentally inexpressible, something that we feel, an emotion, something that we might use a language like transcendence to try to describe. So we might say of religion that it's the way we talk when we're trying to talk about, you know, seeing a sign, right? Now, to bring those ideas together, we could consider, this is a different perspective again, we could consider that religion exists as a way to articulate what transcendence is, what keeps us from experiencing transcendence, how to clear whatever those obstacles to transcendence might be out of the way so that we can experience it. So that's another way to think about what religion is. There's a whole field of study about our human drive to experience transcendence, and that study goes back centuries, perhaps millennia. It's not a hard thing to observe that we do this as a species, and so when we observe things that we do over time that recur, one of the questions that raises fairly naturally for those who are contemplative or reflective is why? Why does this keep popping up? And this might seem like a little bit of a detour, but I want to pause for a while here to consider some of the reasons that thinkers have suggested for why we seem so committed to this search for transcendence. And it seems to me, in our context, that it might be worth digging around in a bit, since it shows up so often as an explanation for why we keep making religions, even when religions seem consistently to provide people with rationale or systems of belief that cause great harm to other people who don't believe the same way, or to the surrounding world, or to neighboring cultures that don't believe the same way. Those kind of divisions, it can foster division. It's not the only thing it can do, but it's one of the things that it does that makes us go, why do we keep making this thing if it causes harm? And it is an easy explanation, a little too easy, I think, to say we keep making it because it also does good, right? But I want to not just duck out the side door here. I want to stay in the search. So let's define a key term, because there are many possible ways to use a word like transcendence, right? So let's start simple. Let's say that transcendence is the act of rising above something to a state that is superior to the previous state. So rising above something to a superior state. The word itself, as we have it in English, comes from the Latin prefix trans, which means beyond. So trans often gets used as short form in our cultural conversations this moment for transsexual. So if you just think about that as beyond, so beyond the binary stereotypes is what that gestures toward in the language of identity and all of that. So this Latin prefix trans, and then so beyond, and then the word scandere, which means to climb. And so we achieve transcendence when we climb or have gone beyond ordinary limitations. So that's sort of what's built into the word itself. So when we plug that understanding or that knowledge into the realm of religion or spirituality, we might use this word to describe moving into a realm that is beyond the physical realm, or into a space that we might call or use the language like spiritual for, right? Or beyond the limits of what we can usually see or know fully using only rational means, which of course is also the foundation for many of the arguments against the legitimacy of spirituality or the spiritual, which is that it does move into a realm that we can't fully account for with the rational. So for those who say that, I think, therefore I am, that the rational's still paramount, that makes the things that go beyond that or transcend it, suspect. So there's that aspect of it. Now, it's not that hard to see, I would contend at least, that we've got a pretty big human drive toward transcendence, and that drive is not limited to the realm of religion. And maybe that's easiest to see or illustrate by pointing out how transcendence is present in ordinary things, at least as we've defined it. So, for example, when we're hungry, we crave food to transcend, to rise above hunger. When we're tired, we crave rest to transcend fatigue. When we're rested, we crave activity to transcend repose. Maybe that's not an experience you've had yet today. When we look at it that way, we can see how the drive or craving for transcendence is both powerful, because it moves us into action, right? But it's also potentially futile. It's born fundamentally in those illustrations out of dissatisfaction. And it could be understood to set us on this treadmill of always reaching but never fully grasping. If you've grown up, for example, around expressions of religion that include this notion of sort of sin versus holiness, for example, you might be able to appreciate how we can never really arrive at this, in that system of belief, at this desired destination of being sinless. And so we need to interject an idea like grace to fill this gap between the transcendence we desire and the reality of how close we can get to what we're longing for, or to what we've been taught is this ideal state of being. Now, that's one particular lens on this drive to rise above the ordinary. One sort of particular way of looking at it and saying, that's why that's there. And there are a few others, sort of a greatest hits when it comes to explaining why we seem to keep coming back to this project of seeking to somehow rise above what we can see and touch. And this is a bit of a longer list. The list itself is not original to me, but I've modified it for our purposes. And if it helps you to relax and just listen as we work our way through these, I can promise you that I'm not going to stop and investigate every one of them. So with that in mind, some reasons why we might seek to rise above, to transcend, even when we can see some evidence that such a search might in the end prove futile. So I'm just going to work my way through these and sort of unpack them a tiny bit, and then we'll go on from there. So the first of those reasons why we might lean into seeking to transcend, even with evidence that we're not sure it'll actually accomplish what we're looking for, and so these are powerful drives, right, that could get us past that objection. The first one is that we might want relief from suffering, and not that hard to understand how one would want such a thing. And we might also assume, rightly or otherwise, that transcendence of some sort will aid us in finding that relief. So we seek transcendence or transcendent experiences because in those experiences we believe, or perhaps we've even had a taste of how they relieve us from suffering. That's the first one. Second one is that we intuit or we sense that there's some aspect of our being that seems much vaster than our perception or our cognition, bigger than what we can know through our senses or what we can think our way into, just kind of using our brains and minds, that there is something beyond our best and our biggest understandings. And we have, in this view of why we see transcendence, we have some kind of reflex that makes us want to deepen that awareness or deepen or strengthen that connection. So there's a drive that's like breathing, a reflex, right? Or swallowing. It's built into us, and it pushes us toward this when we see these limits. We might also think that we continue with this project because we have had the felt or affective experience that we've been separated from a state of existence where everything was right, that there was such a state, that we were connected, that our existence was unhindered, it was flawless, and we want to return to that unitive ideal state. This, by the way, this view is pretty much a way of describing the idea shapes that are running in the background of the Hebrew Genesis poems, as well as many other sort of redemption narratives that we might be familiar with, depending where we grew up, in terms of religion. So, for example, this is the idea shape that is running in the background of this idea of a broken relationship with God that needs to be restored, right? That there's this previous existence where everything was right, something's wrong with it, we want to return to that state. So that's another lens on this. Another one, and here I'll use language that tends to get used in these kind of worldviews for the mystery that we use God language for. In this view, we might believe that we have been touched in some way as a species by the flame of divine love, that something that is big L love has touched us, and that inspires us, that touch inspires us to be entirely consumed by that fire. Now again, this sort of mystical language for some kind of, We might have encountered this in various expressions of religion, various expressions of Christianity. This, if that's the religion we grew up with, this commitment to be caught up somehow in ways or to degrees that, you know, burn away anything that might come between us and these transcendent experiences. And that's the kind of language that gets used, right? We're going to burn this, and there's going to be this holy fire that's going to burn away the things that get between us and the divine, and that divine love. So that's another way we could think about that drive. Another one is that we might believe that we have had, we may be very convinced, we may be so convinced we could not be convinced otherwise, that we have had some kind, and we have a memory of it, we could tell you the story, we've had some kind of ineffable or indescribable or remarkable peak experiences that have challenged our previous sense of self. We've experienced something, and we can't necessarily explain the experiences, but we know. Air quotes on no. We know that when we had those experiences, we felt like a different person. We felt like we were connected to everything. Maybe we felt like we were connected to everyone. And that experience suggests to us that our previous conceptions of reality are inadequate. Maybe they're even false. And it's up to us to do whatever we need to do if we wish to revisit the perspective that we touched on when we were having those peak experiences. And because those peak experiences tend to transcend the ordinary, they may become very desirable. Now, we might also have had transcendent experiences that were not desirable to repeat. We might use the language of bad trip for some of those, right? They were an alternate reality, but not one we want to return to. So there's that as well in that same category. We might even feel, if these were positive experiences, we might even feel like we're not living with integrity if we don't do everything within our power to pursue this. So those experiences could be incredibly powerful ones. They can reshape our lives, right? So that's another possible lens on seeking transcendence. Another one is that we experience that we are unsatisfied with the perceived or maybe experienced limitations of our existence. We keep bumping into the edges of what we can know or what we can do, and we fervently wish to believe that there is something more, that there is, in fact, the possibility of transcending those limitations. And so our drive comes from seeking what that might be. And then finally, this isn't exhaustive, but I think it covers quite a bit of ground. We might believe that of ourselves as a species, of our humanness, we might believe that our imagination is boundless, has no boundaries, and that our ability to learn is likewise ongoing. It doesn't have an edge. But we recognize that our current understanding and experience of understanding is finite and it's incomplete. And so we have a tension to resolve. We believe our imaginations are boundless and our capacity to learn and grow is boundless, but the experiences we're having are limited. How do we resolve that? And we might believe that this is a tension that can only be resolved through broadening our experience and expanding our understanding, or sort of to return to our use of the language of transcendence, by continually seeking to rise above our current understanding. So there's sort of a greatest hits, like I said, of some of those ideas. But regardless of which, if any of those perspectives might resonate for us, there's still an open and maybe bottomless question as to why we might have this seemingly built-in drive toward transcendence, because almost all of those explanations, one way or another, say there's something inherent in us as a species that, and back to the argument that this is what makes us unique, that drives us to both, gives us the capacity to and motivates us to imagine someone or something not just existing, but being present and active in the world. Right? So that idea. So why might we have such a drive? Now, we could say, this is the point where we should stop asking why. And maybe you're tired of it. In any case, we should just say that that's how it is. Clearly, history shows us over and over again over time. We have this drive. So why do we breathe? Well, we kind of, we just take it as a given. We have this drive. Some of us would find that an acceptable way to proceed, and others of us not so much. We want to continue to lean into the why, and leaning into the why is where we find a lot of the meaning in our lives as well. So I'm gonna for those of us who might be so inclined, I'm going to explore that a little bit. Again, there are several different perspectives on this question of why we might have this drive toward transcendence. I'm going to take it as a given that we have such a drive. Not everyone would agree, of course. But I'm going to take that as our baseline here and just press into some possible understandings of why that drive might be there for us as human beings. So again, this is a collection of ideas that have existed for a long, long time. In many cases, these themes are ancient, but they also have contemporary expressions. They're still around. And as you know, if you stick around my talky bits anyway, you know that I believe that those enduring themes are very important places to explore when we're exploring what we believe, because the fact that they keep coming up suggests that they're pointing to something bigger than, say, the current zeitgeist, or ideas that are just about the current setting or the nature part of the nature-nurture equation, for example. All right, so I expect that that some of you are going to recognize the underlying ideas of religious teachings that you've taught, have been taught or encountered in some of these ideas. And it's worth keeping in mind, we'll get to the ideas in a moment, it's worth keeping in mind that many of these ideas are quite a bit older than the writings that pick up on them. So if you've encountered these ideas in sacred texts in your own journey through religion or systems of belief, or you're encountering them in contemporary systems of belief, it's worth noting that all of these go back a long, long ways. And sometimes they travel to the edge of our European concept of history, which, of course, is what's written down. And they just go right over that horizon, and they keep going as far as we can tell. And just a reminder as well, as we dive into this, so we don't kind of get lost in the blizzard of ideas here, the reason we're looking at these ideas in the context of this talky bit is we are looking at ways that people have addressed the question, why do we have this built-in drive to seek transcendence? So that's the vantage point from which I'm thinking of or examining these. And again, there's a few of them. So Stay with me. Okay, first of all, some would suggest that the reason we have this drive is because there's a fragment of what some would call the divine spark, some sort of residue of God that lives in us as humans and that naturally yearns to be reunited with its source in God. In the history of Christian beliefs, I'll pick some high-profile ones. And again, these are Eurocentric because that's where the history of Christian belief tends to reside. So we might equate an idea like that with Pascal's idea that within each of us there is a God-shaped vacuum. There's a space that is attracted to God and attracts us toward that particular expression of the divine. Or we might see this idea in Augustine's suggestion and well-known quote that our hearts are restless and that they will remain so until they rest in God. So this idea that there's a residue of God that lives in us that yearns to be reunited with its source. So that's that idea. That's that particular why. Another one that addresses itself to this is this belief that the potential for liberation or true freedom underlies all existence. I don't know if any of you have had occasion to study or be aware of what sometimes gets just lumped together as liberation theology in Christian history, the history of Christian beliefs about God, but this shows up there, for example. So this belief that this is potential for liberation underlies all existence, but our minds tend to keep distracting us from it. Having said that, we can still apprehend hints of that liberation and a possibility that what we need to do, what our job is to do, is just to remove a few obstacles, and then we could enter this alternate, more kind of true and pure, this liberated experience. In the Christian narrative, the language of freedom is often used. In the Hebrew narrative, freedom from slavery often references some of these kind of ideas. And we might recognize here, depending again what we grew up with, we might recognize here some resonance with the writings of Paul, the Christian writer, who suggests that we presently see reality through a glass darkly. We perceive reality as a distorted or partial reflection, but that is all going to come clear when we're face to face with the divine. So that's drawing on this idea. All right, another one is the idea that in our own willfulness and ignorance, we have turned away from the light through which all things came into being. That's an interesting metaphor because light, of course, is one of the first things that shows up as an expression of the divine in the Hebrew creation poems, the Genesis poems. But in this idea, we've turned away from that light, but the light patiently waits for our return if we can embrace its gracious loving kindness. And so we're actors in that story. There was this light that generated everything that is. We've turned away from it, but we can return. It's up to us to embrace it. It's always there waiting for us. Now, I don't know about you, but anybody else out there sort of hearing something like all have sinned and come short of the glory of God in their mind right now? Or maybe you're seeing a copy, if you're a visual thinker, maybe you're seeing sort of a copy of Rembrandt's The Prodigal Son painting in your imagination. Anyway, whatever it is, that's this idea applied to Christian notions about the nature of God and humanity. And of course, there are other notions about the nature of the divine and humanity, or light and dark, or whatever the metaphor is, that build on this same idea. All right. Now, this next one might sound a little bit more woo-woo than the previous ones. You're like, oh my goodness, more woo-woo, Tim. But that's only until you kind of start to take it apart. And I think you'll recognize that the things that sort of sound a little bit like the creators of the Matrix movies were working with, we'll get beyond that, as powerful as that may be. This is simply the idea that the individual self is an illusion. See what I'm saying? In other words, this is the idea that we are somehow all part of a larger whole, perhaps a greater consciousness. That's language that often shows up these days in this part of the world, that we have this drive to transcend because we are trying to experience the whole rather than the parts, that is what's built into us because that is our nature, that we are a part of a larger whole. And so we're just naturally trying to get to the experience of the fullness of that. This idea sort of shows up in most religions under the notions of that we're all, if we're truly doing this work, if we're truly seeking this particular transcendent experience, that we are part of one family somehow. In Christian theology, this shows up as ideas like the church prop, like the bigger idea, not local, but the church universal. It shows up in ideas like the bride of Christ. It shows up in ideas, again, sort of Hebrew ideas, like the notion that we are all made in the image of the divine, or some unifying metaphor that says, essentially, we're all connected. So that's that idea. We're all connected at the source. We have a fragmented or partial experience of that, and we're trying to get back to the fuller experience of it, to transcend those partial experiences. So there's that one. Here's another one that's sort of like that, but a little bit different in the language and some of the perspectives. And that's the idea that we as a species have forgotten who we really are. We've forgotten why we're here. We've forgotten the nature of all spiritual existence. But in this idea, it's the language of universe that shows up, that the universe keeps prompting us to remember, that we're surrounded by reminders of the thing that we've forgotten, and our job is to pay attention, to be present, if you will. So you might recognize that language in this. So just in case anybody was thinking that the language or the, you know, the universe manifesting something, which seems to be enjoying a bit of a resurgence at the moment, was new, that is not a new idea. Its prevalence in our zeitgeist and our wider conversations in this part of the world might be relatively new, even as part of, we could understand that as part of spiritual language kind of getting out from underneath the control of Christian versions of spiritual language and being more present in the wider cultural conversation. But the idea itself is not a new one at all, which doesn't reduce its merit, just to be clear. I'm not saying that in a negatively critical way. So here's another one. Is this idea that in the process of creation, when things came to be, matter somehow in that process was alienated from spirit. But since we humans consist of both, we're constantly trying to reconcile the two. And that's why we have this drive to transcendence. We're trying to get the pieces back together. I've mentioned this idea before, but it remains a heartening possibility to me as carried by language. And that's that some would contend and have sought to demonstrate that the linguistic, the etymology of the word religion is in fact a medical etymology or history, and that it at its roots, the word religion refers to religamenting, religion, to healing something, putting something back together that's been torn asunder, you know. It's the reconnection of the ACL, of the tendon to the bone, you know, like putting together something that's torn, right? And so in this idea, that's where the drive comes from, is that we are alienated from something essential in the process of creation, the separation of matter and spirit, and we're trying to get them back together. And again, that's an idea that shows up in lots of ways and lots of different systems. Pretty much any body-spirit dualism, which includes much of the history of Christianity as well, not least of all, sort of courtesy of the Apostle Paul and his writings primarily. He seems especially enamored with ideas like this. So for example, kind of encouraging his followers to punish the body to free the spirit. He had some body issues, I would say, from our perspective at least. This also shows up in Augustine's ideas about the fall or human brokenness. They tap into this perspective that these pieces are alienated and we're trying to reconcile that alienation. So there's that one. Here's another one. This comes from more of an evolutionary perspective. And that's the idea that we as a species live in the midst of an ongoing evolution of the whole being, of spirit and matter. Or sometimes the language in these worldviews or systems of belief will talk about how we are constantly in the middle of something that is unmanifest, manifesting itself, sort of in an ongoing way. It's like we're peeling an onion. And things are being revealed in an evolutionary way. That's another way of saying we keep evolving. And as part of our experience of that evolving, we're motivated to keep looking for ways to integrate spirit and matter, or to move toward wholeness, or in many practices, to move toward what the practice would refer to as balance. Right? So that's kind of that, some of those ideas summed up. And here's the last one. All right, and then we'll kind of come out of these and sum up a little bit, and that'll be where we leave this for the time being. So here's the last one. This is the idea that our consciousness has what some would call an inquisitive seat that the at the root of our consciousness is inquiry, and that our consciousness has evolved to improve the survival fitness of our species. Not that hard an argument to get your head around, right? And that our consciousness has a yearning that's built in, evolved, for a more complete knowledge and understanding that will consistently improve our survival fitness. So that the primary drive here is actually survival. It's biological, but also built into our brains and our minds by experience and by biology. That one of our most basic drives as a species is towards survival, which I think is a meaningful lens on many of our drives. And one of the ways in this argument that we get better at surviving is by constantly seeking to know more, to understand more, to connect the dots more, to integrate more, to rise above or transcend whatever our previous best understanding was. And that we're driven to do that by the desire to survive better, longer, all of those kinds of things, to rise above our previous best experience. Whew. Okay. My studying with Taya, one of the things that many contemporary profs do, and some of you that teach in our setting will know this and have different approaches to it, but they both lecture, they talk about ideas, whether that's in a virtual setting or an actual classroom setting, and then they put slides on the screen. They put up this PowerPoint or whatever that has content on it, and then sometimes that content is also published in a way that's accessible to students, so there's some content they can go back and refer to if they miss things in their note-taking or what have you. I sort of feel like, I mentioned that this morning because I sort of feel like I should have put up some PowerPoint slides. That's a lot of ideas. And of course, there will be no test other than, you know, life and how we live it. But no exam about our knowledge. That's not the kind of context we're in. We're in a context of shared exploration. If some of those resonated for you, I hope that they were sticky enough that you can refer back to them in a meaningful way. If you want to know content about any of that, like if you find like you feel like you heard an idea that was like, huh, that was interesting, but it whizzed by, and you'd like to know more about what I kind of was working from in terms of my notes or anything like that, if you think that would be helpful, just be in touch with me by email. I'm happy to share what I've got written down in front of me, if you think it would be helpful to you. Okay, that was quite a survey, right? That was a lot. I'm going to leave it there for today. And I'm going to pick up next week with some consideration of how some of these ideas might factor into our own exploration, and in particular, how they might apply or help us with the work of teasing apart what I'm going to call religious values as distinct from religious identity. All right? So that's kind of the terrain that we're headed into, because that's something that seems to be happening a lot these days. I feel like I have lots of conversations with people who are like, yep, I recognize that many of the values I hold, the things I really care about in the world, the things I try to enact in my own life, that those could be understood as Christian ideas, but I don't identify as a person of Christian faith. It's another way of thinking about that spiritual but not religious conversation, right? The religious idea is about identity. The spiritual idea is about values, we could say. So we're gonna kind of tease that out a little bit next week. If you want a simple takeaway, because again, sort of a blizzard of ideas, if you want a simple takeaway, you might want to try something like this. So this week, whenever you find yourself thinking about or enacting transcendence-seeking thoughts or practices, and that may be as simple, as basic as, I am hungry, I wish to transcend that hunger by eating, having something come into my body to feed my biology here. And if it's good enough, we might argue that it feeds our spirit as well, mightn't we? But if you're having, you find yourself thinking about or enacting some kind of transcendence-seeking thoughts or practices, you might want to pause, I mean, for a count of 10. Like, I'm not talking about rearranging everything in your life, but just a conscious pause to ask yourself, why do I do this? What's the drive? What's behind this? And to just see if there's a connection to one or more of these ideas that we've considered today. Is there an explanation here that I work with all the time, but not consciously, that I just assume? Because those are very powerful. Assumed beliefs have a unique power because they often become unconscious, and we start to regard them the same way we regard other unconscious things like breath or gravity, or, you know, and that's both uniquely powerful when we have beliefs like that, but it's also uniquely hazardous in the sense that we might be enacting something that if we examined it, we would discover we do not believe, or we used to believe and no longer believe, or we have an evolving shape of belief around what have you. And becoming conscious of those things, externalizing them, and then bringing them back into our lives in a deliberate way changes the way they operate in our lives and subsequently the way we operate in the world. Right? So just take a moment and ask yourself, why do I do this transcendence seeking thing? Do I know why? Do I have an idea about why? Because if you have an idea about why you do it, that's a belief. And when it comes to exploring what we believe, this is how we do it. We stop and go, oh, I believe that. That's one way to describe the belief that's running in the background. Do I believe that? My actions suggest that I do. Are they consistent with this? And so on, right? And so that's how we do the work of exploring what we believe. All right, so there's if you wanted homework, some curious people do. And I think there's some of them in the community because we want to change, right? And sometimes that takes practice, doesn't it? So if you want to practice something this week, you can do that. If I'm doing a transcendence seeking behavior, even of a simple sort, why am I doing it? All right. That's it for today. Going to wrap it up. If you're joining us today by podcast, thanks for being with us that way. If you join online, if you're watching this online, thanks for joining that way. It's been good to be with you, and I look forward to the next time that we're together. Peace to you.